previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
People were saying, what's going on here? Why all this violent crime? Why now? What's in the air? People felt they were cursed. They felt something otherworldly was happening. People moved.
A single upstate New York town is a magnet for tragedy in Village of the Damned, and the single bullet theory is put to the test in JFK the Smoking Gun. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 33. Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, the previously.tv take on TV true crime. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined by guest and spouse, Dan Patrick Brady. Hi, honey.
Hi, honey.
Thanks for joining me to talk about the latest attempt by Investigation Discovery to class up the joint. That's in our Most Wanted section. Village of the Damned will be airing Tuesdays at 10 o'clock on Investigation Discovery. So as you're listening to this, it premiered last night. It is the story of a single town in not really that far upstate. It's not even as far north as Syracuse. Let's read the case synopsis per the Investigation Discovery press materials. Legend has it that the quiet and picturesque village of Dryden, New York, inspired Frank Capra's vision of Bedford Falls and It's a Wonderful Life. But contrary to that image, Dryden became the setting for a strange string of tragedies and murders between 1989 and 1999 that left residents wondering why death stalked their beloved town. To them, it was a tragic coincidence, but outsiders gossiped about a curse, labeling Dryden a real-life village of the damned. Residents have maintained a code of silence until now. I did not really know what to expect with this series. Investigation Discovery's limited series have improved slightly of late, like over the last year and a half, over their general Wives with Knives branding that I would say they started out with. But I think they're definitely helped in the case of this series by the fact that these people have never talked about what happened in the town before, have never talked about these cases. Let's listen to clip two, and then I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean.
I opened the door, tried to switch on the light. The light blew, and then as I walked around the room, I found the charred body. It was shocking. This was the first murder victim I had ever seen.
I mean, okay. The wind effect is a little much. But
so is the da-dum. I didn't notice that, but yeah.
Yeah, but that is effective. The production design generally does give you a real sense of what it is like to be in the middle of the state of New York in the wintertime. This particular case, which is the case that they lead with in the premiere, is a Christmas home invasion in which an entire family, husband, wife, two kids, was killed. The guy that we just heard talking was the trooper that came on the scene. Him gagging in the hallway is, I guess, a little funny, but it also felt very real. I'm sure that this happened. It humanized everyone in the situation for me. And it was just a pleasant change from, I don't know, the often over-rehearsed talking head interviews that you tend to get in a 48 hours or a Dateline. What did you think of these?
I think the reenactments, for the most part, they were brief, which is always good. and they were well done. The sound, for the most part, was instrumental. No pun intended. The lighting was very good. You really get a sense of place. I will point out that I did not see the wrong year of car at any point in time. I think that's important.
Good for you.
And the actors, for the most part, seemed to be well cast, resembling the people that they were supposed to be. And they seemed to be real people, you know. So the reenactments were good. I always question about whether they're actually necessary. I think they are to a degree, but what strikes me and struck me with this show is the true tales of horror that all these people basically told, and the way they told it. And I think that reenactments are just overused in a general sense. And in this particular case, I really think that it would have been great to have spent more time with the actual people who went through all this stuff, because they carried the emotion, they carried the feelings of horror splendidly.
No, I agree. I thought that, again, you don't see, like, when you're interviewing a family for a Dateline or something like that, it's not as though these people have been on every single show. Like, you might see that with certain cases, like Natalie Holloway's family. They probably sound a little canned. But what I liked about this one is that the townspeople, with a couple of exceptions, which we'll get to, because they hadn't really discussed this string of cases and tragedies before, they weren't straining so hard to make it sound, you know, poetical and tragical. And as a result, the tragedy and the bittersweet quality of some of their remembrances can just come through. I'm going to play clip three. And this lady, who reminded me of Patricia Clarkson, maybe was trying a little too hard to make an impression, but I really liked her comments in clip three.
It reminded me of, like, the Sharon Tate murder and In Cold Blood. You know, super sensationalized because they are absolutely out of the bounds of what any of us ordinarily perceive as human nature.
First of all, that's exactly right. Second of all, what a timely comment, even though she couldn't have known that, we covered the In Cold Blood, the Clutter murders on the podcast in our last episode, nor that Manson would have died relatively recently. But I really liked the just directness of that, you know, this preoccupied them all because it was outside of the bounds of human nature. What, you know, that's a perfect comment.
Yeah, this was a truly horrific crime. There's no better way to put it. I don't know if I should describe it. I don't want to disturb the watching of the show, but this is I would say probably a family's worst nightmare come true.
Yeah. And perpetrated apparently by a mother-son team who then were busted using the family's credit cards, but it was bad. The entire family was killed. The teenage daughter was assaulted, interfered with, as they used to say in the paper 100 years ago. It did remind me, the reason I make that reference is that I'm currently reading Bill James's The Man from the Train. This serial murderer from over a century ago regularly killed entire families and interfered with the daughter, regardless of her age. Good book, though. I recommend it, but it's not a, you know, lighthearted kick up your heels thrill ride, certainly.
Don't read it at home alone.
No, don't. Seriously. There was creaking in our bed and breakfast last week when I was reading it, and I was like, Yeah, it was probably just the little mini fridge turning on. But yeah, here's another clip. This is one of the victims, Dodie's sister, describing this this toy that used to belong to her sister that she sort of rescued after the bodies were set on fire, which, yeah, also that happened. Here's clip four.
So this doll was a baby doll that was given to my sister Dodie on her very first Christmas. I was so numb, and it was still very unreal to me. But walking into the house, and when I saw this doll, and I broke down. There's, you know, another discoloration, which was as a result of the fire, you know, that couldn't be repaired. But basically, I had a new wig put on her to bring her back to her original beauty.
I mean, if you tried, if you were making like a whatever, not mockumentary, but if you wrote that moment, it would be too much, but it was sincere. Also, I feel about dollies the way most people feel about clowns. I also feel that way about clowns, kind of, but I mean, this was very affecting and
yeah,
sincere, and I felt, I mean, it was nice of her to share that
with us. This poor woman was, she was incredibly effective at telling the story. And she made me rue the way the show was set up, in that you couldn't just spend more time with her, because it was just a perfect portrayal of someone who cared about their sister. This incredibly shocking thing happened, and she's had to carry it all these years. She never gets distraught or anything like that, but just with every word that she expresses, you sense the weight.
It doesn't feel exploitive, or it didn't to me. It just felt like this is a sad story, and we are telling it now. But
It's kind of rare for investigative discovery to be able to do that. You know. So that makes this show one of the best that they've ever done, just because they didn't hit you over the head with a hammer at every possible moment. They let these people speak for themselves,
You're mentioning how the show is structured reminded me that I wanted to mention that they do structure the show very cleverly in terms of carrying you forward along with it. We received two screeners, and I told Dan, just watch, you know, do what you can of it, as my mother used to say, when we were confronting a hated vegetable on our dinner plates. they start with this case of the home invasion at Christmas, and then sort of partway through the first episode, they add the disappearance of this 2-year-old, Eliza Mae Bush. And that brings you to, as of the end of the first episode, there's like only the one case that is in progress, because they're doing it sort of chronologically and all these things are kind of overlapping. So in the second episode, you begin with Eliza Mae, and then at a certain point, like a second case, or really the third case overall, is introduced to that episode. And then they end on this outstanding cliffhanger where basically, a breakup went bad and the guy came to get his vengeance on the new boyfriend. And then the last footage that you see of episode two absolutely made me want to, you know, like, usually I watch these things, I'm like, that was okay, I'm all set, don't need to keep going, I got a lot of other shit to watch. This one I'm going to keep going with, and I think it was very clever of them to drop things in that order. Did you agree?
Oh, I totally. I mean, first of all, the way the whole thing is set up, you could sort of make a justification, because the little girl crisis does chronologically happen right after the home invasion. I think one was at Christmas and one was in February, if memory serves.
Yeah, Groundhog Day, I think.
So you can sort of see how that naturally would progress. But basically what they're doing is they're selling this as an entire series of these incredible things happen to this one small town. And this method of doing it gets you involved so that you will see the entire series through. And I was really struck by the end of the second episode because they did a great job.
Let's just say it's not a talking head interview subject whom you expect to see.
No, not at all. And it brings up 1,000 questions that make you immediately want to wait, you know, to hang out for episode number 3.
I mean, look, this show is not. The show is not perfect. This is like, we're not talking about The Keepers or The Jinx even. There is some horrible reenactment acting. Let's hear that. Clip 5.
I'm sorry. I didn't get your name.
Doesn't matter.
What?
Everybody shut up.
What are you doing?
I said shut up. Who else is here?
No one. My husband's at work.
Nobody else is here?
No, it's just the 3 of us.
Okay. Usually, that lady who is playing Dodie is good. That actor is good. But in that particular clip, she just sounds really annoyed at being home. She's like, it's just the 3 of us. Now get out. But yes. The guy... Awful.
Well, I thought about this, and I think it's, you know, first of all, this is a crime that happens. How do I put this? All right, here we go. This is a man of color killing a white family. So, and he's the only man of color, obviously, in the entire show because that's television. And most. A lot of people's mindsets. And so he, I'm sure the actor is thinking to himself like, oh great. Now I have to be this, you know, this stereotype of the angry, you know, vicious, black person killing someone. And, so I don't think his heart was really into it for 1,000 reasons. And also
I appreciate what you're saying, but that is an indefensible line reading. I'm sorry. I'm just going to have to disagree with you.
Yeah, it is.
I'm
also
going to
lead. Like, what? I'm also going to state this by saying that it balances out the incredible gravity of what the sister is talking about. She knows the pain. These actors, I mean, they're obviously like, okay, we're set for the shot, go. And these guys, they just are nowhere near what one needs to portray a scene like this.
So your feeling is that this is intentionally poor to provide the viewer with a little relief from the heaviness of the rest of it?
No, I just think that it's actually just a very hard thing to do. And this is another problem with reenactments in that I'm sure they've got 15 minutes to shoot the 8 scenes that they have to shoot, you know, and they're like banging them out.
Well,
and
I guess, but at the same time, they took care, like the wardrobe master or mistress of this project really took care to get like the one... the mom of Eliza Bush, her like puffy socks, which everybody totally wore those everywhere until like 1992. In another scene,
sure, honey.
A reenactor is what it's set in, I guess, 92 or something like that. And she's wearing a like just way too big for her jean jacket with the sleeves cuffed up, which is totally how we wore it. So the soundtrack can be a little on the nose, but it's well done. Like, this is a considered project. And then this guy who just sounds like he has been eating nothing but cheese for 2 weeks, everybody, shut up. Like,
well, I mean, he just, as a performer, did not get there.
No. You know?
And all you've got, you don't even see the man's face. You just have, you know, you see it, it's shot from behind him. So you see his head and shoulders and you're seeing the mother's.
And he takes the gun out of his waistband and
Yeah.
Another issue I had, we should move on from this poor man who knows, maybe they just they're just like, the guy who's supposed to come is sick. Hey, you.
Right. Hey, you right over there.
And I understand why they do this, I guess. And I tried to be very good about not rushing to Google to see what actually, how these cases actually turned out. Although in the case of Eliza Mae Bush, I do feel that the fact that they had the reenactor playing her mom smoking badly, this actor never smoked before, in seriously every scene was meant to telegraph that she was evil. But we'll get back to Eliza in a moment. Here is what we are told quite late in the presentation of the home invasion case about the possible motivations in clip six.
The police believe that this was a robbery gone out of control. Mrs. Harris had a gift shop on the premises. It was just before Christmas when the crime occurred. So the thinking was that he would be able to get cash from the till.
My thinking as someone who considers narrative for a living is that I understand why that lead was buried, but it was buried too far. Did you find it still a little jarring that we only heard about that?
That wasn't the burying that bothered me. What bothered me the most was the giant grave that they dug, and then tossed in. Oh, by the way, the cops lied about the mom, and fingerprints at the scene, and then they go nowhere with it.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot about that.
You know, just for our listeners' sake, what basically happens is that they establish that the mom runs a cleaning service, and they establish that they haven't been able to find any.
The mom of everybody shut up guy, not the mom who was killed.
No. Bad mom. So bad mom and bad son, they assume, cleaned the house after the crime was committed, and they. And that's how they were sort of able to get away with it for a while. But to make that happen, they established that the mom was at the scene by illegally putting her fingerprints on something, on the gas can that they used to start the fire. And the show does nothing but that. And
well, we are told that she died a free woman, quote unquote, in 2015.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know it could have gone in an entirely different direction, and then maybe didn't have time to deal with this or anything like that, but it's just
You're absolutely right. I had completely forgotten about that, and it does seem like they could have made more of it, because given the sort of like snowballing shit show that was like bearing down on this town with, you know, various crimes. And I don't know what else we're going to see in the future of the series, although I am going to keep watching, that they could have just made a comment that was like, this cop like needed something to break law enforcement's way. And so he planted this fingerprint. I mean, like a line about that is not a defense of it, but yeah.
Well, I suppose it could have been an explanation. I don't remember where they said whether the cop went to jail or not for that, which he should have. I think he did, but I don't remember. The woman, bad mom, does die a free woman. I mean, all.
Well, that bad mom.
That bad mom, yes. Now, what about the other bad mom, honey?
I believe the other bad mom is still alive. Episode 2 has not aired yet.
Yeah.
I suppose y'all could Google it. Like, this stuff happened 25 years ago. It's not a spoiler. But I do want to come back to the weightiness of the interviews that we hear with law enforcement and with just the real people who were contending with these very dark times. Here's a clip from a cop that goes back to that sort of like, not, I mean, poetry is not the right word, but let's just go with it. Accidental poetry of real people discussing their experiences and not trying to make too much of an impression like you usually see in shows like this in clip 7.
The FBI came in. We had an 800 number put in, and that opened the floodgates to many, many, many phone calls. It seems like back in that year, every two-year-old must have wore a pink winter suit, you know?
There's just something about that image. Like, of course a two-year-old girl has a pink winter suit. And it's like, well, I saw someone in a pink winter suit. Like, There's just something about that detail that really got me. And then we have the Eliza's mother's then boyfriend, I think.
Yeah.
He's talking at the end of the clip that we're about to hear, but I believe the beginning of the clip is a state trooper in clip 8.
And then we uncovered the body branch by branch. And during this time, Christine didn't say anything and didn't do anything. It was just a very somber moment.
Sickening. Disgusting. Sickening.
I just want the best it can be for Father under the circumstances. You know? Raw deal for him.
That's the mother's then boyfriend talking about the baby daddy, I guess. Spoiler. Eliza did not just wander off. She was not eaten by a bear. But the way they shoot the reenacting of the each branch coming off and you see this trash bag and it's nighttime and snow is coming down. I mean, maybe I'm grading on too steep a curve because it is from this channel, which sometimes can be roll trashy. No pun intended, but I thought it was quite effective and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Yeah, agreed. And then when they begin the sort of third tale toward the end of the second episode, it's once again pretty well done.
Yeah, I didn't cut any clips from that, but that the talking head interviews with the woman who was involved in that case were good.
She was excellent.
Yeah,
yes.
She's good. I mean, they're just very direct, and I think that's a excellent rule of storytelling. Just say what happened, and then the poetical elements and the tragic elements will sort of reveal themselves. You don't have to press quite so hard or have footage of people typing or walking sadly on a boardwalk.
Yeah, I don't wait. Was there any typing in this?
No, they had one. I mean, they didn't do it with any of the law enforcement. And then they had one guy who we heard, a local journalist who I think is now an attorney. Or was an attorney and is now a reporter?
Was an attorney and is now a journalist, I think. Yeah, but he wasn't typing either.
Yeah, no, he was. So. He was just sitting in a diner booth. So
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
They did. There were lots of shots in diners, but that's a real step up for these guys.
Yeah, I think they are making a conscious effort to be a little more respectful perhaps, but also just to take it easy. I mean, I also think Oxygen Network is like eating their lunch in terms of like, preachers on the rampage or whatever horrible niche thing. Hashtag killer post. Oh. So I think Investigation Discovery has or is seeing a real opportunity to move maybe not towards move towards prestige. I don't know, remaking Fatal Vision at half the length with Noel from Felicity is, I don't know if that's the right call, but they're trying things and they're doing pretty well. So we're going to keep watching this, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And the gravity of these stories is such that it really needs that. It doesn't need any of the normal hokum that one would do. So I have a feeling that they were kind of caught up in this. They did for the most part a very good job.
Yeah, I agree. If you'd like to check it out, it's available. Full episodes will be available depending on your provider at the Investigation Discovery website. And you can also set your DVRs for Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. Village of the Damned just started as we're recording this. It will be starting tonight as you're listening, started last night. And I think it's 6 episodes, might be 8. So not a big commitment, but there's not as much new TV on at this time of year. And I recommend it. It's good. All right. Talk about weighty crimes for our cold case. We will be returning to November of 1963 and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm not going to give you a case synopsis of
what
that
happened. I don't know.
Because
tell me about it.
I know. Fast forward to like 6 hours later. I'm shotgunning Ludens. Here's what you need to know. Minutes after John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, conspiracy theories sprang up around how and why he might have been murdered. Minutes after Dan and I met, we began nerding out about our favorites of these theories and the late Howard Donahue's carefully researched narrative of the shocking third bullet is our favorite theory. We are talking about JFK, The Smoking Gun, which was a TV movie that aired a
couple of years ago.
I think it's an Australian project, and I forget where it aired, but it was part of a just barrage of programming from 4 years ago to mark the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's murder. I was sent the book by Boner Menninger. It's probably Bonar. Let's go with Bonar.
All right. So I won't say Boner. I promise.
Bonar, we might call him a boner later. We'll get to it. Bonar Menninger talked to Donahue and basically like translated all of Donahue's work into a book called Mortal Error, which I reviewed on the-blotter.com. And there will be a link to that review in the show notes. We were sent like a, new edition with the foreword by this Colin McLaren guy who apparently ended the Australian mafia. Like, okay. But that's the framing device of the movie, is that they are trying to explain to you Howard Donahue's theories. Donahue was hired to be one of the expert marksmen in that 70s reenactment where they like put targets on a track and tried to see if
it was actually, I think, 1968 CBS or something like that.
Oh, was it earlier than that? Okay.
A little bit earlier than that, and they tried to, one of the big questions in the Kennedy assassination of about Oswald was how could he possibly get off 3 shots with the rifle he had in 5.6 seconds or something like that. That was the time that it took for the 3 shots. So they had a bunch of marksmen. They built a sort of a scene, and they had a bunch of marksmen try to do that. And Howard Donahue was it took him 2 tries, but he was the only guy who actually was able to accomplish that. And he then became an expert to a degree on the Kennedy assassination. He got to thinking about it. He got obsessed with it began to delve into the – he was a ballistics expert. He began to delve into the case.
And there was definitely some pushback, as we'll hear in clip 9.
You know you're going to get a lot of criticism when you publish this theory.
Why, of course we are. But then again, those people don't know anything about firearms, ballistics, or bullet performance.
I think that his publisher was sued by the Secret Service.
Yes.
Too long didn't listen version. Here's the theory. Oswald got 1 shot off, which missed. The ricochet clipped Kennedy, who said, "I'm hit." The second shot, did go through the so-called magic bullet, did go through his throat, did hit Connolly. Most people misunderstand where Connolly was actually sitting in the car. It is totally possible for a, you know, jacketed round to go as far as it did. This probably would have killed Kennedy, or at least left him paralyzed from the chin down. But a hungover Secret Service agent who was not usually on gun duty and was dealing with a machine gun that had a loose trigger. They didn't really get into this in the special, but once the safety was off, the thing would just fire itself practically.
It was an AR-15.
Yeah. His car picks up speed and it like hits a bump or something and he shoots Kennedy in the head, basically.
Yes.
So that's where, like, you have the Oswald shots, which are fairly like neat entry wounds, but then that third and final bullet, which everyone thinks came from the grassy knoll and exploded in his skull and like game over.
Yeah.
That was from the Secret Service, who refused to discuss it, closed ranks over this guy, Hickey, I think his name was.
Yes, his name is Hickey. And yeah, they definitely closed ranks. They were got in the way of the autopsy. They were the people behind moving Kennedy out of Texas to get him back to Washington to the autopsy there.
Well, and you kind of can't blame them, especially at that particular
sure.
point in human history, that it's like, what good does it do? Particularly
yeah.
when Oswald's shot probably would have killed him. What good does it
yeah,
do?
I mean, that's something that I don't remember it's definitely brought up in the book, Mortal Error, which is a good quick read. I definitely recommend it. It isn't brought up in this episode, but it's very true. I mean, Kennedy was incapacitated by the second shot, so and they take pains in Mortal Error to say that at the end of the book, they're like, we are not trying to pin the death of a president on this man. We're just trying to get at the truth.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. Immediately after that, you get this sort of constant barrage of press releases that become truisms or truthiness about the fact the Secret Service are ready to die for the president, and they're champions and good and everything over evil, et cetera, et cetera. And that sort of remains how Americans look at them for the next several decades. We now know that not to be true.
Well, actually,
lots of shenanigans that have happened.
Well, and let's hear clip 10.
What Howard Donahue now realizes is that his suspected second shooter has been hidden in plain sight all along, inside the Secret Service follow-up car. Only one camera captures that agent at the scene with an assault rifle in his hands. His name is mentioned several times during the Warren Commission.
Howard came to a passage that describes an agent Hickey with the AR-15 pointing it around aimlessly around the plaza or something to that effect. And Howard saw that reference and he was stunned.
Yeah, I mean, they're not like trying to scapegoat the Secret Service, although... All right, I'm just going to skip ahead to clip 12 because they're pretty interested in making it clear that the Secret Service was probably still drunk from the night before.
Yes.
Here's clip 12.
During the Texas trip, the Secret Service detail is working double shifts. The past 3 days have been brutal with no end in sight. The night before the assassination, a number of Secret Service agents go out in the town. Secret Service agents are a dedicated, close-knit band of brothers. The downsides of the job are long hours, endless pressure, and lots of time away from home. Heart attacks, alcoholism, and even suicide are occupational hazards.
The Secret Service agents put JFK to bed just after midnight, and then for some strange reason they went bar hopping.
and they were seen to be in the company of scantily clad women, as the Warren Commission called it, strippers, in other words. And the drinking went on till just after 5 a.m. before they went back to their rooms to prepare themselves for a 7 a.m. start.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I'm not saying that wasn't a factor. I'm not saying that hasn't been a factor on protection details as recently as the Obama administration. Like, these are human beings, and some of them are dicks, and some of them have addiction problems. Like, that's whatever.
Yeah, they're human beings.
Yeah. Here's what I love about that clip also, is that the way they phrase it, like, they put Kennedy to bed at midnight, like they tucked him in and read him Captain Underpants, and then they left a nightlight on, and here's your teddy. Like, I bet there was a teddy, all right.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah.
Yeah, but honey.
I think overall, this movie, it's, we'll link to it in the show notes. You can watch it on YouTube. It's free. At least the link that we'll provide. It's a very good, like, adaptation of the book, and it sort of walks you through Donahue's qualifications, what he discovered, and the evidence. It's not too sensationalistic, and it's very straightforward and orderly, but I don't know what the Sam Hill accent anyone in this next clip is going for. I think the first guy is shooting for Texas and landing somewhere in New Zealand. And the second guy, Agent whatever, like, I can't even tell what his name is because I think he's trying to have a Boston accent, but it's more like Adelaide. Clip 11.
The body cannot leave this hospital until after an autopsy has been performed.
So this is the body of the President of the United States, and we're going to take it back to Washington.
No, now that is not the way things are done. When there's a homicide, we must have an autopsy.
Well, he's going with us.
The body stays.
My name is Roy Kellerman. I'm a special agent in charge of the White House detail for the Secret Service, and we are taking President Kennedy back to the Capitol.
No, you are not taking him anywhere. There's a law here, and we are going to enforce it.
Is that law that your accent has to rocket all over the southern United States before crashing into the Gulf of Mexico? Because consider it enforced.
Yes. They
walk out to take it back to Washington. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah, most people, I mean, you know, being a former actor like that and being a southerner, most people, I mean, they think it's an easy accent, and it is not. And of course, it varies as one moves across from east to west across the United States. But yeah.
Yeah. The only South that had anything to do with is New South Wales. Like, as someone who was always trying to do a Tar Heel accent and winding up somewhere in Savannah. I get it, but I'm not getting paid to do that. You might pay me to stop.
The irony of this is that investigation discovery reenactments were far superior to what they did this show.
There is some fair bit of stalling. Like, there's a shot of the Jackie reenactor just like sobbing in an anteroom, like.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like, the reenactments are not good, but at least they're over quickly and there's not a whole lot of filler. There's a little bit, the middle's a little squishy. But overall, I think it's good, and I think it does well at summarizing. Like, it doesn't try to bring in every single fact that anyone has ever unearthed, Oliver Stone style, about the assassination. It just focuses on, like, what it knows and what it's trying to say.
And it makes a really great point. I mean, I have to point out that this, this was actually made from a book. I think that the Colin guy, the Australian detective, wrote, I read that too, and that's basically his book and the movie is really just supporting what Howard Donahue said.
Yeah.
You know, saying this is true. I mean, we think this is true. This makes logical sense, and it does. And the point is that that there were Full Metal Jacket rounds that went through the body of the president. And then there was another round that exploded in the middle of his head, which means that it was shot from a different kind of gun. And the only kind of gun that's on the scene happens to be the AR-15 that's being held by a Secret Service agent. And by the way, Hickey, one other casualty of the drunken episode from the night before, Hickey was a driver. He wasn't, I mean, that's what he did for the Secret Service. He wasn't necessarily a guy who knew that much about firearms or anything else. I'm sure he was trained to a degree, but he really should have been the last person who was in the back of the car.
And, yeah, I think he was relatively new. So like,
he was relatively new. He had 4 months on the service, according to the show. He was basically chosen for it because he was the soberest person they had.
Yeah, I think he didn't even go out with them. Is the sad part is that they were like that they're all wearing like three pairs of sunglasses and they're like, "Hickey, get in the I'm gonna barf. Get in the jumpsuit."
Movement.
The original book by Bernard Menninger is great, and I recommend that people try to get that. Their hands on that. I think it's out of print, but I mean, at like any used bookstore in Cape Cod is going to have at least two copies. It is possible that Mr. Menninger is maybe a little too close to the case. His writing is extremely good, very unobtrusive, very clear. But I think maybe he needs to think about something else for a while. Clip 13.
Was there a conspiracy to kill JFK? Howard was agnostic about that. What he did do was show that it couldn't have come from the grassy knoll because there's no entrance wound on the front of Kennedy's face and no exit wound on the back, and it couldn't have come from the overpass because there was 12 other people up there. What Howard proved, in my view, was that Oswald didn't fire that shot, and most likely it was fired by Agent George Hickey from the follow-up car accidentally in the panic of the moment. You know, in the chaos of combat, he's trying to respond, he's trying to do his job. He's probably already acquired Oswald visually, gonna return fire, and fate intervenes. It's sad. I mean, it's sad for him, it's sad for the country. It was a tragedy.
Well, yes, but as a topic you've been immersed in for some years now, it does seem perhaps like maybe you were out drinking until 5 o'clock and you need to calm down a little bit. Also, I would like to note that one of our cats chose this very tender moment to stampede up and down the hallway between our offices, freaking out. So if you heard me giggling, that was why. Do you have anything else to add before we go into our final clip, which is something of a summary of what you can expect if you elect to watch the movie?
I'll just say that I think it's important to see this because I do think that, I have read The Book of Death, which is, the world's largest book ever written.
The late Vincent Bugliosi wrote the definitive single shooter. Like, it's a cube. It's a doorstop. It's massive.
It's 50 pounds at least. And it hurts to read it because it will crush your innards as you lay it in your lap. But I read that front to back. I've read a lot of books about Kennedy over the years. And I'm sorry, this makes sense. I don't want to... So I think this is important for people to take a look at.
If you're interested in this case, I think it is essential, because I will say this: before I read the book, at least, I was one of those people who believed whatever the last theory was that I heard. So if I happened to run into JFK on cable, I was like, oh yeah, it was totally this, you know, web of Louisiana conspiracy, Cuban, whatever his, you know, whatever his conclusion is. If the last thing I read was, what is his name? Gerard Posner. Sure. Single shooter, Warren report, totally accurate. So my ideas of it were very changeable based on whatever the last thing I read was. But once I had read Mortal Error, I never changed my theory again of what happened.
Yeah, I mean...
And again, it's totally not that Oswald didn't shoot him. It's that yes. The reason that half his head was taken off is because, you know, panic of the moment, as Benar said. But let's hear our final clip, which sums it up pretty neatly. Colin, hit it.
I really believe this is what happened.
Three shots are fired. The first is by Lee Harvey Oswald. It misses, but a ricocheting fragment of the bullet hits the president, causing him to say, "My God, I'm hit." At the sound of gunfire, Agent George Hickey turns to look up at the sixth floor window. Oswald fires again. The second bullet enters the president's back and exits his neck, hurtling forward into Governor Connolly's back and exiting through his chest. Hickey picks up the AR-15 to return fire and flicks off the safety. As the follow-up car lunges forward, he loses his balance and accidentally pulls the trigger. The presidential car is rushed to Parkland Hospital, where McLaren believes a cover-up begins.
So there you have it. Once again, that'll be in our show notes. And that book is by Benar Meniger. It's called Mortal Error. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this, Dan.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Very exciting stuff.
Where else can listeners find you and your work? Eventually, we'll track down your Unsolved Mysteries episode, but until then...
Yeah, that's what everyone needs to do. There's one episode of me in Unsolved Mysteries playing a... was I a detective or I was a policeman or something like that, but not in a uniform... doing so many stupid things that the actual policemen who were on the set with us just looked at me and shook their heads. So find that episode.
Yes, if you can find that episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which is probably available with your Amazon Prime subscription, a shiny previously owned copy of Mortal Error can be yours, can be thine. Scout's Honor. If you can find us that episode, I will treat you to a book. Probably help to know what Dan looks like. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Patrick Brady. Thanks for coming on the show, honey.
It's my pleasure.
Coming up soon, the Jeffrey McDonald, played by Noel from Felicity Project, I mentioned earlier, with guest John Ramos and an exegesis. Just kidding. What I mean is that we're going to make fun of it. Of Homicide for the Holidays on Oxygen. My name is Sarah D. Bunting, and you can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can follow this podcast on Twitter and like us on Facebook at Blotter Presents. And of course, we'd love to hear your theories of this and every other crime we discuss on our forums at previously.tv/forums. Talk to you next time.
Production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.